This lecture, entitled The Myth of the Missing Link and the Fossil Record, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the parents, children, and family of Dr. and Mrs. Paul and Mary Zeidel. As we stated in a previous lecture, according to Talmudic tradition, the entire universe was created for man, specifically for the Jewish people, those who fulfill God's covenant and uphold and study the Torah. And we have the, on page one, we have the citations. For that reason, much of the creation narrative focuses on man and his unique creation. And again, here we have on page two, in section two, the verses from scripture relating to the creation of man. It is evident from scripture that man's role in this world, as well as his spiritual and physical creation, was unique. The Torah is based on the idea of a creator and that life was pre-designed. This is in stark contrast with Darwin's notion of evolution, that everything came about through chance and natural selection. In previous lectures, we discussed Darwin's theory of evolution as it related broadly to the plant and animal kingdom. When it appeared in 1859, the theory was controversial enough, and Darwin didn't want to lessen its impact by embroiling himself into the issue of man's possible animal origins. Even though he hinted to it at the end of his initial work, this is on page 373 on the Origin of Species, that over time, quote, much light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history, end quote. 12 years later, in the year 1871, in his work, The Descent of Man, Darwin declared unequivocally that man, despite his special intelligence and spirituality, was descended from some earlier primate or ape. My object, declared, says Darwin, this is on page 446, is to show that there is no fundamental difference between man and the higher animals in their mental facilities, end quote. He argued that they all have, quote, similar passions, affections, and emotions. Even the more complex ones, such as jealousy, suspicion, emulation, gratitude, and magnanimity. They possess the same faculties of imitation, attention, deliberation, choice, memory, imagination, the association of ideas, and reason, though in very different degrees, end quote. Thus, he says, quote, the difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is, certainly is one of degree and not of kind, end quote. To Darwin, the commonality between man and animals also extended to the spheres of morality and religion. Accordingly, this is on pages 471 and 472, any animal, whatever endowed with well-marked social instincts, the parental and filial affection being here included, would inevitably acquire a moral sense or conscience as soon as its intellectual powers had become as well, or nearly as well, developed as in man, end quote. As to the origins of religion, Darwin wrote, quote, the tendency in savages to imagine that natural objects and agencies are animated by spiritual and living essences, which Darwin, by the way, compared to a dog's tendency to imagine hidden agency in things moved by the wind, would, quote, would easily pass into the belief in the existence of one or more gods, end quote. Thus, quote, the feeling of religious devotion, end quote, is merely a higher form of the, quote, the deep love of a dog for his master, end quote. Darwin, by the way, viewed the various races of man as a result of the same dynamic that brought forth the various varieties of animals with the same natural process of selection, preserving only the most fit. We can see in his words and approach the roots of the Nazi movement and many of the evolution-based ills of modern history. In Darwin's own words, on page 156 of The Descent of Man, quote, at some future period, not very distant, as measured by centuries, the civilized races will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state, as we may hope, even than the Caucasian, and some ape as low as a baboon instead of now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla, end quote. In other words, he felt that Negroes, Australians, I mean the Aborigines and gorillas would be exterminated, become extinct in a short period of time. And what would remain would be a more advanced Caucasian and the less advanced baboon. In a similar vein, on pages 133 to 134, he wrote, quote, "With savages, the weakened body or mind are soon eliminated, and those that survive commonly exhibit a vigorous state of health. We civilized men, on the other hand, do our utmost to check the process of elimination. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed and the sick. We institute poor laws, and our medical men exert their utmost skills to save the life of everyone to the last moment. Thus, the weak members of our civilized societies propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man." And it continues on, "Excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed." End quote. Basically, our friend Darwin felt, like Hitler after him, that the weak should be eliminated. Despite all of Darwin's rhetoric, the differences between man and ape are enormous. And Darwin and his followers knew that if their claim was to be accepted as scientific fact, rather than a mere rewording of Epicurus's materialistic philosophy, it was crucial that some sort of fossil evidence of some intermediate between man and ape be found. Much of the history of modern science and culture revolves around the attempt by Darwin's followers to convince mankind that they are indeed animals and not a special creation. In the following section of this lecture, I would like to trace the history of the search for the missing link. In the year 1856, 3 years before the publication of The Origin of Species, a human fossil different and seemingly more primitive than modern man was found by quarrymen in a cave in the Neander Valley near Dusseldorf, Germany. Known as the Neanderthal man, it was the first early human fossil type to be recognized by science. It quickly became part of the controversy over Charles Darwin's views of evolution. Coincidentally, Neander, the place where it was discovered, means new man in Greek. It was really named after a Protestant minister, Joachim Neumann. He got a Greek name. The rest is history. Since the initial discovery, many Neanderthal finds have been found at sites from the English Channel Islands throughout Europe into Russia, as well as Uzbekistan, Iraq, and Israel. These fossils have the following features in common: a long, low brain case with a sloping forehead and a large projecting brow ridge, a large and projecting face, often without a chin, and an upper jaw lacking the indentation just above the canine teeth. It's called the canine fossa, characteristic of living humans. Neanderthals had large brains, often larger than those of modern humans. They possessed rugged, muscular bodies and were shorter in stature than most living humans. In addition, the original fossils had a stooped, ape-like appearance. Although the world-famous pathologist Rudolf Virchow of the University of Berlin claimed that these were just another race of humans and the stooped appearance was only a result of arthritis and rickets, a bone disease caused by vitamin D deficiency, Darwin's followers, in particular Thomas Huxley, viewed these finds as evidence of evolution, the anticipated missing link, those primitive life forms that were supposedly the ancestors of modern man. In 1908, Marcel Boule, head of the Institute of Human Paleontology at the Museum of Natural History in Paris, working with a fairly complete skeleton, which was found near the French city of La Chapelle aux Saints, popularized what became the standard depiction of the Neanderthal. an ape man stooping with head thrust forward and knees bent, suggesting an ape-like gait. As a result, for more than 40 years, the Neanderthals were depicted to the public as being apish brutes, naked, hairy, and wielding clubs. Such icons had a great role in convincing the public that Darwin's theory of the origin of man was correct. The man is merely an advanced ape. By the way, scientists today no longer maintain that Neanderthals are the missing link between ape and man, and neither do they view them as being any closer to apes than man himself. In the year 1955, anatomist William J. Strauss of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and A.J.E. Cave of St. Bartholomew's Hospital Medical College in London, attending an anatomy conference in Paris and viewing Bull's reconstruction of Neanderthal fossil, realized that he'd made significant errors. In a subsequent article in a quarterly review of biology in 1957, they wrote, quote, "There is nothing in this total morphological," is the outside pattern, "to justify the common assumption that Neanderthal man was other than a full erect biped when standing and walking. It may be that the arthritic, quote-unquote, old man of La Chapelle-Assomption, the postural prototype of Neanderthal man, did actually stand and walk with something of a pathological kyphosis, a hunchback. But if so, he has his counterparts in modern men similarly afflicted with spinal osteoarthritis. He cannot, in view of his manifest pathology, be used to provide us with a reliable picture of a healthy, normal Neanderthal. Notwithstanding, if he could be reincarnated and placed in a New York subway, provided they were bathed, shaved, and dressed in modern clothing, it is doubtful whether he would attract any more attention than some of its other denizens," end quote. Now, I'm not sure if this says more about their opinion of Neanderthals of New York subway. In addition, the fact that Neanderthals had on average a larger skull than modern man seemed to go against accepted evolutionary thought. Today, they're no longer depicted as ape men. There was evidence that they buried their dead with great care. One was found interred with a bouquet of flowers, and they used tools. There's also evidence that humans and Neanderthals coexisted in the Middle East, perhaps thousands of years, using the same kinds of stone tools and hunting the same animals. In 1997, researchers were able to analyze a fragment of DNA from a Neanderthal bone, discovering Neanderthals were a distinct variety of Homo sapiens and not the hoped-for missing link between apes and present-day men. But Neanderthal man was only one of many candidates for the elusive title of the missing link between man and the early primates, the ultimate proof that we are descended from apes. One of the earliest candidates was the so-called Java man. The story actually began with German zoologist Ernst Haeckel. If you remember, it was he who doctored the pictures of the embryonic development of the different species and coined the phrase ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Haeckel became convinced of the existence of an ape man who was ancestral to modern man, the so-called missing link, and had a painting of such a being commissioned, and he named it Pithecanthropus allalos, which means ape man without speech. Pithecos is the Greek word for ape, and this is anthropos is Greek for human. So that's why together, you know, the Pithecanthropus, then allalos is without speech. Haeckel was also convinced that man separated from apes somewhere in Africa or southern Asia. So it was there that Pithecanthropus must have lived. One of Haeckel's students, Eugene Dubois, a Dutch physician, anatomist, and geologist, became determined to find this Pithecanthropus. And to this end, he signed up in the year 1887 as a surgeon with the Dutch Medical Corps and served for 8 years in Dutch East Indies, which is now called Indonesia, intending to hunt for fossils in his spare time. The military authorities cooperated in the search by giving him 50 forced laborers and 2 army corporals as supervisors. After years of fruitless search, in 1891, along Java's Solo River, the laborers discovered a tooth and a skull cap. The dome of the skull doesn't mean a yarmulke here. It means the dome of a skull. The latter was seemingly ape-like, having a low forehead and large eyebrow ridges. The following year, diggers unearthed a thigh bone that was clearly human. This was found in a different place. And a year later, although Dubois was first inclined to regard his teeth and skull cap as belonging to a chimpanzee, not a human, after reflection and consulting with his mentor, Professor Haeckel, he declared them to be the long-lost missing link and named it Pithecanthropus erectus, or erect ape man, because the thigh bone was that of a human. I mean, so. After the completion of his term of duty in 1895, Dubois traveled through Europe, lecturing and proudly displayed his discovery at International Congress of Zoology in the Netherlands. His finds were largely greeted with skepticism. British zoologists tended to view the finds as being human. German zoologists viewed them as being the remains of an ape. In the words of Professor Rudolf Sierkow, who had been Haeckel's professor and at that time the world's recognized expert on human pathology, quote, "In my opinion, this creature was an animal, a great gibbon. In fact, the thigh bone has not the slightest connection with the skull," end quote. Dubois also failed to reveal that he discovered a nearby Wajak at approximately the same level where he found Java man, two fully human skulls with a cranial capacity of 1,550 to 1,650 cubic centimeters, somewhat above human average. That means, in essence, the Java man, or wherever he was contemporaneous with modern man, and therefore couldn't be the missing link. You know, you're looking for something that's older, presumably, than man. You know, he couldn't be the missing link, the assumed ancestor of man, Der Alte Zeide. Wasn't a good candidate. In 1907, an expedition of German scientists from various disciplines, led by Professor M. Lenore Salenka, traveled to Java seeking more clues to man's origins. The expedition established a barracks, hired 75 workers, and methodically removed 10,000 cubic meters of material. It sent 43 crates of fossil material back to Germany. No evidence, however, was found of Pithecanthropus. In the stratum of Dubois' find, the scientists found hearths in his fireplaces and plants and animals that looked rather modern, which would be indicative that it was contemporaneous with modern man. In addition, native traditions indicated that the Solo River had changed course in the 13th or 14th centuries. In other words, it was found by the Solo River now, the fossil probably only some 500 years old. Dr. E. Carthaus, a geologist on the expedition, concluded that Pithecanthropus was a contemporary with modern humans. Despite its many difficulties and the report of the Salenka expedition regarding Dubois' discovery, anthropaleontologists today attribute the thigh bone, which appears to be human, to have come from the same creature which produced the skull and teeth, and consider the so-called Java man to be part of a unique species of hominid, whom they now named Homo erectus. The controversy still exists, however, if Homo erectus was an ancestor of man, as Dubois claimed, if he actually did exist, or perhaps a contemporary of man, just like the Neanderthals. But in any case, the evidence is quite sparse. In the words of J.K. Chesterton, quote, he was a famous English writer, "A detailed drawing was reproduced, carefully shaded to show the very hairs of his head were all numbered. No uninformed person looking at its carefully lined face would imagine for a moment that this was the portrait of a thigh bone of a few teeth and a fragment of a cranium," end quote. One of the most interesting discoveries centering around the search for the missing link is the so-called Nebraska man. In 1922, a tooth was discovered by geologist Harold Cook in western Nebraska. At that time, America was embroiled in a battle between fundamentalists who denied evolution, such as William Jennings Bryan, who was battling the teaching of evolution in public schools, a subject of which we will soon speak, and evolutionists such as Henry Fairfield Osborne. After seeing the tooth, Osborne, one of the eminent paleontologists of his day, declared it to have combined the features of chimpanzee, a pithecanthropus, and a man. In other words, it had all these various features. And he named it Hesperopithecus, Harold Cookie. You know, when you have a name, first the genus and then the species. So the Hesperopithecus is the genus and Harold Cookie is the specific species, in honor of Harold Cook. Hesperus means Western in Greek, and Pithecus, as we said before, means ape. It seems that Osborne was particularly delighted that the tooth was discovered in Bryan's home state of Nebraska. In Osborne's own words in his book, Evolution of Religion and Education, published in 1926, this is from page 103, quote, the earth spoke to Bryan and spoke from his own state of Nebraska in the message of a diminutive tooth, the herald of anthropoid apes in America. He continued on, this little tooth speaks volumes of truth, truth consistent with all that we have known before, with all that we have found elsewhere, end quote. William K. Gregory and Milo Hellman, specialists in teeth at the American Museum of Natural History, stated in a May 1922 article in Science magazine that after careful study, the tooth was from a species closer to man than ape. Harris Hawthorne Wilder, a zoology professor at Smith College, wrote in his book, The Pedigree of the Human Race, on page 157, judging from the tooth alone, the animal seems to have been about halfway between Pithecanthropus, the Java man, and the man of the present day, or perhaps better between Pithecanthropus and the man of the Neanderthal type, end quote. In England, the Illustrated London Times published an artist's rendition of the Nebraska man. The picture, which appeared in a two-page spread and received wide distribution, showed two brutish naked ape persons, the male with a club, and the female gathering roots. Unfortunately, fame for this ape man in Nebraska was short-lived. In 1927, further excavations at Cook's site showed that the tooth was actually from an extinct peccary, a close relative of the pig. It seems that the evolutionists quickly and quietly removed Nebraska man from their list of missing links. As one distinguished creationist writer, Dr. Duane Gish, wrote, quote, I believe this is a case in which a scientist made a man out of a pig, and the pig made a monkey out of the scientist, end quote. One of the most famous and subsequently discredited discoveries of fossil man was announced in 1912. Between 1908 and 1912, Charles Dawson, an amateur fossil hunter, recovered pieces of an old human skull from a gravel pit in Piltdown, England, only a few miles from Darwin's home. The find impressed Arthur Smith Woodward, director of the Natural History Museum of London, and they, together with the famous and controversial Jesuit priest, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a paleontologist and outspoken Darwinist, continued to dig deeper at Piltdown. Further digging produced a lower jaw, ape-like in appearance, but with teeth too short for an ape. The skull and lower jaw were assigned to the same individual, and it was said to be 500,000 years old. Dawson and Woodward announced the find in December of 1912, and on December 22nd of that year, the New York Times ran a story, headlines, Darwin's Theory Proved True. Although a few paleontologists, such as Boole and Osborne, thought the jaw and skull belonged to two separate beings, the overwhelming consensus of the scientific community was that it came from the same body and represented the missing link. It was appropriately called Eanthropus Dawsoni, because Dawson found it, or Dawn Man. For the next four decades, Piltdown Man was evolution's greatest showcase, featured in textbooks and encyclopedias. Many papers and doctoral dissertations were written on Piltdown Man. The scientists who had worked on the fossil and verified its authenticity There's this Arthur Smith Woodward, who, as we said before, director of Natural History Museum in London. Anatomist Arthur Keith and brain specialist Grafton Elliott Smith were all knighted. Clergymen who denounced evolution were all ridiculed. Evidence from the Piltdown Man was cited in the famous Scopes monkey trial, of which we will soon speak, proving that Darwin was right. The British Museum proudly displayed a plaster cast of Piltdown Man, and hundreds of thousands gazed upon the likeness of their alleged ancestor. Alas, despite his temporary fame, just like in the case of the Nebraska Man, fate was not kind to the Piltdown Man. In 1950, a method became available for assigning relative age to fossil bones. This method is dependent on the amount of fluoride absorbed by bones from the soil. In 1953, this method was used to date the Piltdown Man. The jawbone was found to contain practically no fluoride, meaning it wasn't a fossil at all. It was judged to be no older than the year in which it was found. The skull was found to be old, but not 500,000 years old, the date that Woodward estimated, but only a few thousand years old. The bones were then subjected to thorough investigation. It was discovered the bones had been treated with iron salts to make them look older. And scratch marks were detected on the teeth, indicated that they'd been filed down. In 1982, this is collagen testing proved conclusively that the jawbone was an orangutan's. A whole literature developed trying to prove who had perpetuated this hoax. But in any case, the Piltdown affair severely undermined faith not only in the integrity of the scientific establishment, but also in the judgment of those serious scientists who had truly dedicated themselves to finding the so-called missing link. The stories I just related are not just isolated incidents that occurred many decades ago. Duane Gish, in his informative work, Evolution, the Challenge of the Fossil Record, relates the following. A UPS press release of May 14, 1984, revealed that a skull fragment which had been hailed by experts 1 year earlier as the oldest human fossil ever found in Europe may have come from a donkey. The fossil had been found in the Andalusian region of Spain, at southern Spain, and a three-day symposium had been scheduled so that participants could examine and discuss the fossil, which had been dubbed Orsi Man, for the southern Spanish town near which it was found. When French experts revealed the fact that Orsi Man was most likely a skull fragment from a four-month-old donkey, embarrassed Spanish authorities sent out 500 letters canceling invitations to the symposium. End quote. Before I discuss the most recent fossil discoveries, hopeful missing links, it is important to realize that science knows virtually nothing about man's origins. All of it is pure speculation. Yet, if you look at the media, look at National Geographic, you're left with the impression that evolution, including human evolution, is a proven fact. The secular community has done a yeoman's job convincing the community at large of their position. One of the great turning points in our history where the position of creationism became discredited and the position of evolution became associated with scientific fact and general enlightenment occurred in July of 1925 with the Scopes, or so-called monkey trial. I'd like to digress for a few minutes to acquaint you with the history of that trial, give you a sense of the power of the press, and how it had such an impact upon this country. And again, it's a known fact, and amongst generally educated circles in the universities, if one questions the quote-unquote fact of evolution, you're viewed as someone who really believes in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. And how that came to be is to a great degree due to the Scopes trial. So I think it's really important just to understand what actually occurred to give you a sense of why America Americans and educated people across the world think the way they do. In March of 1925, the state of Tennessee had passed what was known as the Butler Act, which forbade teachers in public schools to teach that man was descended from lower life forms. It did not forbid, by the way, the teaching of other aspects of evolution, just merely that man was descended from other primates or lower species. To give you a sense of the sentiment of the populace at that time, at least in the state of Tennessee, the act passed overwhelmingly 71-5 in the state house and 24-6 in the state senate. Similar laws had passed at the time in two other states. Shortly after the act's passage, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, which was founded just 5 years before in 1920, and then is today the vanguard of liberal thought in the defense of civil liberties and the separation of church and state, began running ads in Tennessee newspapers offering to pay the expenses of any public school teacher who would volunteer to challenge the Butler Act and teach evolution. George Rappelier, a manager of a mining company in Dayton, Tennessee, noticed the ad and convinced local businessmen that such a challenge and the resulting trial would put Dayton on the map and hopefully turn around its sagging economy. Subsequently, the men, together with quote-unquote Doc Robinson, the owner of a local drugstore and the president of the school board, approached one of Dayton's school teachers, John Scopes, in Robinson's store. Scopes was actually not a biology teacher. He was a popular football coach as well as a math and physics teacher and briefly substituted for the local biology teacher when he took ill. In his autobiography, entitled The Center of the Storm, on page 60, Scopes later recalled the conversation he had in the drugstore with Doc Robinson and the other men. "You filled in as a biology teacher, didn't you?" Robinson said. "Yes," I nodded, "when Mr. Ferguson was sick." "Well, you taught biology then. Didn't you cover evolution?" "We reviewed for final exams as best I remember." And Scopes continued, "To tell the truth, I wasn't sure I had taught evolution." Robinson and the others apparently weren't concerned about this technicality. "I had expressed willingness to stand trial. That was enough," end quote. It seems that on the spot, the town's prosecutor swore out a warrant that was handed to the accused. And as Scopes headed out to a tennis game, the prosecutor called the press with the news. I mean, the whole thing was a setup. In the book, The Great Monkey Trial by L. Sprague de Camp, the author relates the following conversation between Scopes and the reporter William K. Hutchinson of the International News Service. Quote, "There's something I must tell you. It's worried me. I didn't violate the law." "A jury has said you had," replied Hutchinson. "Yes, but I never taught that evolution lesson. I skipped it. I was doing something else that day, the day I should have taught it. I missed the whole lesson about Darwin and never did teach it. Those kids they put on the stand couldn't remember what I taught them 3 months ago. They were coached by the lawyers. And that April 24th date was just a guess. Honest, I've been scared all through the trial that the kids might remember I missed the lesson. I was afraid they'd get on the stand and say that I hadn't taught it, and then the whole trial would go bluey. If that happened, they'd run me out of town on a rail." "Well, you're safe now," said Hutchinson. By the way, it seems that virtually every biology teacher in the state taught evolution. As Scopes himself told them, "Evolution is explained in Hunter Civic Biology, and that's our textbook." So there's nothing special about Scopes. Shortly after the Dayton businessmen had decided on their plan, they were informed that citizens of Chattanooga, Tennessee, were going to beat them to it and were trying to initiate their own court case. That worried Daytonians after letting the Chattanoogians know that if they did this, they would boycott their businesses. So they hurried up on their own preparations to quickly bring Scopes to trial and receive their needed publicity. And publicity they did receive. The ACLU brought to Dayton one of this nation's most famous defense attorneys, Clarence Darrow, who volunteered his services, as well as a team of lawyers including Arthur Garfield Hayes, a famous and well-respected civil rights attorney, Dudley Field Malone, a New York divorce attorney, and to provide them with expertise of local law, Tennessee attorney John Neal. The city of Dayton, not to be outdone, used as one of their leading prosecutors one of the nation's most famous citizens, William Jennings Bryan, who had volunteered his services. A former U.S. congressman, three-time Democratic presidential nominee, and Secretary of State, Bryan had been a major force in American politics for three decades. Bryan was also a fundamentalist Christian who was opposed to evolution, and in fact, the year before, 1924, had drafted a Florida law similar to the Butler Act, forbidding the teaching of evolution in public schools. To put this in perspective, the United States was in the midst of the Roaring Twenties. Prosperity combined with a freer lifestyle, secularism was on the rise, and religion was beginning to have much less a hold on this country. In a sense, then, the struggle in Dayton, Tennessee was in miniature the struggle between the old values and religious sentiment and the new. The nation as a whole viewed this trial as a key battle in the struggle for the soul of America. And as a result, the trial was broadcast by radio across the country and reported in all of the newspapers. What is noteworthy is the ACLU knew that Mr. Scopes would ultimately be convicted of the crime, a crime, by the way, that only carried with it a $100 fine. After all, he never denied the so-called fact that he had violated the law, which in fact he did not. And the truth is that at the end of the trial, Clarence Darrow actually changed Scopes' plea from not guilty to guilty. In Clarence Darrow's own words to Judge Ralston, quote, "Let me suggest this. We've been all here for quite a while, and I say it in perfectly good faith. We have no witnesses to offer, no proof to offer on the issues that the court has laid down here, that Mr. Scopes did teach what the children said he taught, the man descended from a lower order of animals. We do not mean to contradict that, and I think to save time, we'll ask the court to bring in the jury and instruct the jury to find the defendant guilty." End quote. This is from the transcript of the trial. The ACLU hoped, though, of overturning the Butler Act by using the trial and all its publicity to make a mockery of the belief in creation, and eventually, through the appeals process of having the law overturned and declared unconstitutional, an infringement of religion upon free expression and the quote-unquote truths of science. To this end, Clarence Darrow first called to the stand Maynard Metcalf, a zoologist from Johns Hopkins, who testified at length about the scientific basis for the belief in evolution. After it became clear that Darrow planned to bring not just one, but a team of expert witnesses for the purpose of promoting evolution, remember the trial was being broadcast by radio across the country and reported in all of the newspapers, William Jennings Bryan demanded the right to cross-examine the witnesses. After all, as we pointed out in previous lectures, the theory of evolution faced and still faces many difficulties, such as a lack of transitional living forms or fossils. In other words, they're distinct between invertebrate and vertebrate, between the various distinct phyla. There's nothing in between, nothing living and nothing, as we found, dead. The fact that evolution is not occurring now, except in a very minor manner. The fact that planned breeding, the closest thing to natural selection, does not and cannot produce changes in the species. A pigeon remains a pigeon. The prosecution on cross-examination would also force many of the witnesses to admit under oath they were actually atheists, a fact that would tend to undermine the defense's case. After all, if one is an atheist and believes that everything must have come about through natural causes, then evolution, despite its many difficulties, must be true. There's no other viable option. For someone who entertains the belief in God, a being who is not limited to create solely through evolution, the evidence for evolution then becomes less compelling and its faults all the more glaring. At this point, Clarence Darrow decided that instead of having his witnesses being cross-examined, he had them write written affidavits for eventual submission to an appeals court. The whole weekend, eight scientists dictated 60,000 words to stenographers. Copies were given to the press and excerpts were read aloud in the courtroom. In fact, the testimony of Darrow's witness of Darrow's witnesses occupied 54 pages of the trial transcript without being cross-examined. In retrospect, it seems that most of the quote-unquote evidence that the experts offered for evolution, such as the discovery of the Piltdown Man, now recognized as a hoax, vestigial or useless organs, which have been shown to have important functions, embryonic recapitulation, the idea promoted by Haeckel that the embryo goes through succeeding stages of a fish, amphibian, reptile, and mammal, which we've in the previous lecture, shown to be false. At the time, though, it did seem to make a very strong impression. So this was disseminated through the media. In another brilliant move that seriously undermined the prosecution, Clarence Darrow maneuvered that his opponent, William Jennings Bryan, an avowed fundamentalist Christian, be called to the stand. Over the weekend, as the scientists were dictating their testimony to the court and ultimately the press, Darrow publicly baited Bryan, challenging him to state his views in a courtroom. Under oath, subject to cross-examination, just as he was ready to do to the scientists. In Clarence Darrow's words, as reported in the New York Times of July 18, 1925, quote, Bryan is willing to express his opinions on science and religion where statements will not be questioned, but Bryan has not dared to test his views in an open court under oath, end quote. Bryan accepted the challenge, but he didn't realize or perhaps underestimated the fact that under oath he could only answer Darrow's questions. He couldn't parry with questions and interrogations of his own. It turned out to be a one-sided debate with Bryan the loser. It seems, though, that because of two considerations did Bryan agree to put himself in this precarious position. First of all, there was his pride at stake. Darrow had implied that Bryan was a coward, unwilling to be examined lest the weakness of his position be exposed. Despite the protestations of the chief prosecutor, Tom Stewart, that Bryan not take the stand, Bryan declared to the assembled in the courtroom to great applause, quote, I am simply trying to defend the word of God against the greatest atheist or agnostic in the United States. I want the papers to know I am not afraid to get on the stand and let him do his worst, end quote. But there was another reason as well. Bryan had expected that Darrow would return the favor and also allow himself to be cross-examined on the stand. Bryan addressed the court and said, if your honor please, I insist that Mr. Darrow can be put on the stand and defense attorneys Mr. Malone and Mr. Hayes, to which the judge replied, call anyone you desire, ask them any question you wish, end quote. Darrow himself let Bryan believe that he would be cross-examined. When Bryan was put on the stand, he declared to the court, quote, I want him, referring to Darrow, to have all the latitude he wants, for I'm going to have some latitude when he gets through, end quote. To which Mr. Darrow replied, you can have latitude and longitude, end quote. As we said before, Bryan was at a severe disadvantage, and Darrow did a masterful job exposing his weaknesses. One of Darrow's strategies was to list the various esoteric subjects known only to experts in the field that Bryan was ignorant of. For instance, he asked them if he was an expert in philology, the study of language and literature used in biblical studies. Of course, Bryan kept saying no to these questions, exposing his ignorance. Bryan, though, soon discerned that Darrow himself was also no expert. An example is the following exchange question. Again, he is on the stand, Bryan, here, and Clarence Darrow is doing the... question, this is by Darrow. Do you know how many people there were on this earth 3,000 years ago? Answer, no. Do you ever try to find out? And the answer, when you display my ignorance, could you not give me the facts so I would not be ignorant any longer? Can you tell me how many people there were when Yeshua was born? And Darrow, you know, some people get the facts and still be ignorant. Will you please give me that? You ought not to ask me a question when you don't know the answer to it. Question, well, I can make an estimate. Well, what's your estimate? Wait until you get to me. End quote. And here again we see Darrow was still holding out the promise to Bryan. He was willing to be cross-examined. But it seems that Darrow never really planned to reciprocate and allow himself to be cross-examined. Brian, who had anticipated to be scored his own points in cross-examination, sat stunned the next morning as Darrow changed his client's plea from not guilty to guilty, thus ending the trial. There was yet another advantage for Darrow in changing his plea to guilty. As Kevin Tierney wrote in his work, Darrow, A Biography, quote, Darrow, realizing that Brian might make a comeback by giving a final address to the jury, pleaded Scopes guilty and waived the defense's right to a closing speech, thereby under Tennessee law, depriving the prosecution of the chance to address the court, end quote. Darrow himself wrote in his autobiography, quote, I made a complete and aggressive opening of the case. I did this for the reason that we never at any stage intended to make any closing arguments in this case. By not making a closing argument on our side, we could cut him, Brian, out, end quote. Realizing that he had been taken advantage of, Brian commented that day, and it's in the transcript, I think it is hardly for them to bring into the limelight my views on religion and stand behind a dark lantern that throws light on other people but conceals themselves. End quote. Although Scopes pleaded guilty and was fined, the Tennessee Supreme Court eventually disallowed the fine on technicality, although it upheld the statute. It was Brian, however, and what he stood for was really defeated. He was defeated, by the way, in more than one way. Less than a week after Darrow reneged on his implied promise for equal time, on July 26, 1925, Brian collapsed from a stroke and died. The general impression that was propagated by the media, especially by such secular newspapermen as H.L. Mencken, was that fundamentalism and the belief in the Bible was defeated by the enlightenment of science. That impression was further enhanced by the play and subsequent movie entitled Inherit the Wind, which was loosely based on the trial and presented a very one-sided and prejudiced view of those who believe in the sanctity of the Bible, in contrast with the so-called honest and enlightened modern skeptics. The purpose of this brief interlude was to point out that the accepted view of society regarding evolution, especially after the Scopes trial, i.e. that supposedly evolution is a proven fact, is largely due to the skills of those gifted individuals who popularized evolution, as Clarence Darrow and his ilk, and not necessarily on the merits and evidence they brought to their position. Because the Scopes trial is such a watershed in American history, I think it was just important for you to give you a sense of what occurred. Returning to the missing link, finding our Zetas, you know, it's like, besides Homo erectus, which is the Java man, another candidate for the much distinguished title of missing link surfaced over time. Coincidentally, it was discovered shortly before the Scopes trial. The first to find this creature was Raymond Dart, an anatomist who studied under Sir Grafton Elliott Smith of the Piltdown Man fame. Convinced that man's origins must have been in Africa, Dart traveled to South Africa, where in 1924 he soon discovered the fossilized remains of a small face and jaw in a cave in the Taung limestone quarry. Convinced that the bones had both ape-like and human characteristics, Dart announced he had discovered the missing link, which he called, this is Australopithecus Africanus, or ape man of southern Africa. Because the announcement coincided with the Scopes trial, it received quite a bit of favorable publicity. However, at the time, most scientists rejected his find and claimed that the town child was a young ape whose bones tend to resemble humans more than adult apes. He later found additional Australopithecine remains at a nearby site of Macapanscat, just in South Africa. An additional difficulty was that Dart claimed that this human ancestor was between 2 and 3 million years old. But in 1973, geologist T.C. Partridge reported in Nature magazine that the cave site could not have formed more than 870,000 years ago, And therefore, according to accepted evolutionary theory, this child was contemporary to a more advanced human. A similar find was discovered by anthropologist Louis Leakey in 1959 in Tanzania's Olduvai Gorge, which he named Zinjanthropus, or East African man. Leakey, basing himself on the radiometric dating of the volcanic rock, a subject of a previous lecture, claimed that it was 1.75 million years old. Raising question on the dating was the discovery of perfectly human skeleton the German anthropologist Hans Rieck discovered at a level just above Leakey's find. There's a human just above this. And the Rieck fossil was dated to be only 17,000 years old. On careful inspection, Rieck found no evidence that the human had been intrusively buried. You know, you can bury something deep, but there was no evidence of any burial. The overlying soil was undisturbed, which would indicate the Zinjanthropus was only thousands and not millions of years old. Another problem arose when Mary Leakey, Lewis's wife, discovered circular and what seemed to be a purposely designed stone structure resembling shelters still built by African tribesmen below the level of her husband's find, meaning that man predator was at least contemporaneous with the supposedly 1.75 million-year-old fossil. And you think you have problems. A further challenge to the dating of the Australopithecine arose in 1978, when modern human footprints, indistinguishable from habitually barefoot Homo sapiens, were discovered at Laetoli, another Tanzanian site, in the geological stratum dated to be 3.5 million years old. The distinguished creation scientist Duane Gish commented regarding National Geographic's depiction of life at Laetoli. This is, quote, "Footprints of antelopes, pigs, giraffes, elephants, rhinos, hare, ostriches, and other animals were found at Laetoli. In artists' conceptions of the scene, we see pictures of giraffes for the giraffe footprints, elephants for the elephant footprints, ostriches for the ostrich footprints, etc. And humans for the human footprints? Oh, no. Occupying the human footprints, we see a subhuman creature, half ape and half man," end quote. National Geographic also advanced the fame of Louis Leakey's son, Richard Leakey, by promoting in its June 1973 issue his quote-unquote discovery in the area of East Lake Turkana, Kenya, of skull number 1470, a fossil that looked more advanced than either the town child, Australopithecus, or the Java man, Homo erectus, that which Leakey dated to be nearly 3 million years old. We'll soon see how it was dated. In Richard Leakey's words, "Either we toss out the skull or we toss out our theories of early man. It simply fits no previous models of human beginnings." And continues on, "It leaves in ruins the notion that all early fossils can be arranged in an orderly sequence of evolutionary change," end quote. Eventually, though, a consensus developed for a 2 million-year-old date for Richard Leakey's find, and number 1470 lost its status of being the world's oldest hominid. Today's skull 1470 is classified as Homo habilis, whose place along the evolutionary ladder is unclear. Although the 2 million-year-old date was based on the radiometric dating system, there are other indications that the creatures of this area lived in relatively recent time, as the bones were poorly mineralized and heavy mineralization is generally expected of fossils, which are supposedly millions of years old. It's important to note that this method of dating skull number 1470 through finding is usually one of the major ways, which I believe was used here, was by finding the ratio of potassium and argon and a sample of nearby volcanic rock. In other words, where they found the skull, there was volcanic rock. So if you date the rock, supposedly then you know how old the skull is. But originally, the first dating gave it a date of 200 million years old. Since it didn't fit the evolutionary scheme, you know, we're dealing in the time of the dinosaurs, or before. Since it was too early for man to have appeared, new samples were presented. A date of 2.6 million years was found. This all was also deemed to be too early, and pig fossils found in the area also didn't correlate with that date. After fudging the results, an acceptable date of 1.8 million years, just shy of 2 million years, was agreed upon. To put this dating perspective, the lava dome of Mount St. Helens, which only erupted relatively recently, 1980, gave a date of 2.8 million years using the same method. In the years 1800 and 1801, the Hualalai volcano in Hawaii erupted. Using various methods of dating the minerals contained in the lava, 10 different dates were arrived at, ranging from 140 million years to 2.96 billion years. And it only happened in the year 1800. So although the theory behind radiometric dating seems very compelling, in actuality, when it's checked against known dates, it doesn't necessarily give one much confidence. Another interesting find was that Louis Leakey discovered evidence of Australopithecus similar to the town child, Homo habilis, like skulls as a number 1470, and Homo erectus, similar to Java man, all at the same level in bed 2 of Old Devices' gorge. If so, no matter how they're dated, one couldn't be ancestral to the other. They're all contemporaneous. In addition, according to their dating methods, the specimens spanned a period of from 3 million years to 1 million years, with apparently little morphological change during these millions of years. Not very encouraging from an evolutionary standpoint. Considering the current state of affairs, famed paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould stated, quote, "What has become of our latter if there are three coexisting lineages of hominids?" Thus, he had this is Australopithecus africanus, the tiny child. He had another species of Australopithecus known as robust Australopithecus, like a larger one, and Homo habilis. Nearly none clearly derived from another. So, because they're all contemporaneous, so there's no Zeta, there's no Bubba, there's no Anacle. Moreover, none of the three display any evolutionary trends during their tenure on Earth. They're just the same. None became brainier or more erect as they approached the present day, end quote. This is from an article by Dr. Gould in the Natural History, 1976. For all the fame he achieved, Richard Leakey was upstaged with the discovery of 40% of the fossilized body of an Australopithecine found near Hadar in Ethiopia by Donald Johansson, curator of the Cleveland Natural History Museum. He named it Lucy, because of the Beatles' hit tune, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, was blaring at Johansson's camp at the time of the discovery. Johansson claimed that his fossil was an ancestor to humans, which others hotly contested. After all, Australopithecus fossils show they have long forearms, short hind legs, like today's apes. They also have curved fingers and had long and curved toes, like those apes that swing from the trees. The main claim that Australopithecus was human-like, is that it walked erect, was based on the appearance of the leg and hip bones. This fact also seems to be contested. In the words of Lord Solly Zuckerman, the famous British anatomist who was raised to peerage for his scientific achievements and who was a leading authority in Australopithecines, quote, "For my own part, the anatomical basis for the claim that Australopithecines walked and ran upright is so much more flimsy than the evidence which points to the conclusion their gait was some variant of one sees in subhuman primates, and that it remains unacceptable." He just doesn't see it. In addition, Charles Oxnard, former director of graduate studies and professor of anatomy at the University of Southern California Medical School, wrote in 1987, quote, "The various Australopithecines are indeed more different from both African apes and humans in most features than these latter are from each other." Because they're very different. Like, it's very hard to say that this is an ancestor. Part of the basis of this acceptance has been the fact that even opposing investigators have found these large differences, as they too used techniques and research designs that were less biased by prior notions as to what the fossils might have been. And it continues on, also, most of the new studies have come from laboratories independent of those representing individuals who have found the fossils, end quote. Now, it's important to realize that to an atheist, and we said this before, there's no other option than assuming evolution. There's an implicit faith that there does exist a missing link. I mean, it's Muzdachzan. Therefore, there's an automatic bias to assume that this fossil or that fossil is the missing link because some link, according to evolutionary theory, must exist. The alternative of special creation is unthinkable from their vantage point. For this reason, any evidence that undermines their thesis is somewhat summarily shunted aside. Besides the evidence that we just quoted, there's also evidence that strongly supports the thesis that during the period referred to as the Pliocene era, commonly dated by scientists to be some 2 million years old, modern man actually existed. And this basically implies the whole dating system has to be revised. If this is true, then modern man lived at the same time as the other hominids. And this would be the Australopithecus africanus, Robus Australopithecus Homo erectus, Homo habilis. If they lived, then the whole thing is... And then there's a question on the whole dating system to begin with. But even if you would assume the dating system, you see no evolution. And again, you see no link between the two. None clearly derived from another. And again, the mystery of the missing link remains unsolved. And then the idea of special creation for man becomes much more of a distinct option. Because you see really the whole idea of the evolution is we see a pattern. In other words, it's lower down you go, it's more primitive, the higher you go up, it becomes more modern. That's not the case. I'd like to quote to you from pages 143 and 146 from the book, The Hidden History of the Human Race, a work which we quoted in a previous lecture. This is regarding the Calaveras skull. In chapter 5, I'm quoting from this book, we discuss the numerous stone implements discovered in Auriferous, and is the gold-bearing gravels of Sierra Nevada mountains of California. Human bones were also found in these gravels, which range from 9 million to 55 million years old, and this is according to their dating system. In February 1866, Mr. Madison, the principal owner of the mine on Bald Hill, near the Angels Creek in Calaveras County, removed a skull from a layer of gravel 130 feet below the surface. The gravel was near the bedrock, underneath several distinct layers of volcanic material. This is, volcanic eruptions began in this region during Oligocene. That's dated between 33.7 and 23.8 million years. This is continued through the Miocene, which is dated 23.8 to 5.3 million years, and ended in the Pliocene, which is 5.3 to 1.7 million years. Since the skull occurred near the bottom of the sequence of interspersed gravel and lava layers at Bald Hill, it would seem like this gravel in which the skull was found to be older than the Pliocene, perhaps much older. After finding the skull, Madison later carried it to Mr. Scribner, an agent of Wells Fargo and Companies Express at Angels. Mr. Scribner's clerk, Mr. Matthews, cleaned off part of the incrustations covering most of the fossil. Upon recognizing it was part of a human skull, it was like a regular human skull, he sent to Dr. Jones, who lived in the nearby village of Murphy's and was an enthusiastic collector of such items. Then Dr. Jones wrote to the office of the Geological Survey in San Francisco, and after receiving a reply, he forwarded the skull to this office where it was examined by J.D. Whitney, the state geologist. Whitney at once made the journey to Murphy's and Angels, where he personally questioned Mr. Madison, who confirmed the report that was given by Dr. Jones. Both Scribner and Jones were personally known to Whitney, regarded by him as trustworthy. On July 16, 1866, Whitney presented to the California Academy of Sciences a report on the Calaveras skull, affirming that it was found in Pliocene strata, or earlier. The skull caused a great sensation in America. According to Whitney, quote, the religious press in this country took the matter up and were quite unanimous in declaring the Calaveras skull to be a hoax. Whitney noted that the hoax stories did not arise until after his discovery was publicized widely in newspapers. On the other hand, Holmes reported, Dr. D.H. Dow states that while in San Francisco in 1866, he compared the material attached to the skull with portions of gravel from the mine to find they were alike in all essentials. And H.O. Ayers, writing in American Naturalist in 1882, stated, I saw it and examined it carefully at the time when it reached Professor Whitney's hands. It was not only encrusted with sand and gravel, but its cavities were crowded with the same material, and that material was out of a particular sort, a sort which I had occasion to know thoroughly. It was, said Ayers, the gold-bearing gravel found in the mines, not a recent cave deposit. And therefore, it says it was old as the gravel deposit itself. Regarding the skull, Ayers noticed, it had been said that it is a modern skull which has been encrusted after a few years of internment. This assertion, however, is never made by anyone knowing the region. The gravel has not the slightest tendency toward an action of that sort. The hollows of the skull were crowded with the solidified and cemented sand in such a way as they could have only been by its being driven into them in a semi-fluid mass, a condition the gravels have never had since they were first laid down, end quote. In other words, this came when the gravels came. Assuming the gravels are as old as the volcanic is, in other words, it's according to their dating, this is a time where humans should not have been found. Whitney's in the original description of the fossil observed that the Calaveras skull was highly fossilized. This is certainly consistent with great age. However, as Holmes pointed out, it is also true that bones can become fossilized over the course of a few hundred or a thousand years. Yet geologist George Becker reported in 1891, quote, I find that many good judges are fully persuaded of the authenticity of the Calaveras skull, and Messrs. Clarence King, O.C. March, F.W. Putnam, and W.H. Dow have each assured me that the bone was found in the place in the gravel beneath the lava. Becker added that this statement was made with the permission of the authorities named. Clarence King, as mentioned previously, was a famous geologist attached to the U.S. Geological Survey. O.C. March, a paleontologist, was a pioneer dinosaur fossil hunter and served as president of the National Academy of Sciences from 1883 to 1895. But F.W. Putnam of Harvard's Peabody Museum, as we have seen, later changed his mind, saying that the matrix of the skull appeared to be a cave deposit. Can it really be said with certainty the Calaveras skull was either genuine or a hoax? The evidence is so contradictory and confusing, although the skull could have come from an Indian burial cave, we might regard with suspicion anyone who comes forward with any kind of definite conclusion. The reader might pause to contemplate what steps one would take to make one's own determination of the true age of the Calaveras skull. It should, however, be kept in mind that Calaveras skull was not an isolated discovery. Great numbers of stone implements were found in nearby deposits similar age. And as we shall see, additional human skeletal remains were also uncovered in the same region. In the light of this, the Calaveras skull cannot be dismissed without the most careful consideration. As Arthur Keith put it, 1928, the story of the Calaveras skull cannot be passed over. It is the quote-unquote bogey which haunts the student of early man, taxing the power of belief of every expert almost to the breaking point, end quote. Actually, this statement of Sir Arthur Keith, which is quoted in the book Hidden History, is taken from page 283 of Keith's book, The Antiquity of Man, which he published in 1920. In this book, he concludes his remarks regarding the Calaveras skull and similar discoveries, quote, indeed, were such discoveries in accordance with our expectations, if they were in harmony with the theories we have found regarding the date of man's evolution, no one would ever dream of doubting them, much less of rejecting them. End quote. Okay. So up until now, we've discussed the question of man's origins. Was he created uniquely and literally from the dust of the earth, as the Torah seems clearly to imply? Or was he a product of evolution descending from an ape-like creature many of millions of years ago? What about the apes themselves? Or at least apes that are very similar to man? After all, as been pointed out, there's a great similarity in the DNA of apes, such as chimpanzees, and of man. Is it possible instead of evolution, there was devolution? The lower forms were produced by higher forms? Because of the time, I'm not going to quote this in its entirety, but the Dr. Duane Gish, in his work, Evolution, the Challenge of the Fossil Record, quotes from an article written by Dr. Jeffrey Bourne. He's the director of the Yerkes Primate Research Center of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, who came up with a theory when Richard Leakey's fossil was originally dated to be 3 million years old, which is really earlier than chimpanzees and gorillas. He came up with a theory that maybe chimpanzees came from man. And it was suggested that perhaps that what had occurred was as the apes were changing into man, it was man was in the process that it was like too difficult and they went back to becoming apes. I would like just to share with you that idea here. Here we have on page 3, and this is the idea of, instead of evolution, of devolution. And it's really important to keep this in mind. That one of the major criticisms of the whole notion of evolution is the second law of thermodynamics, is known as the law of entropy. In other words, systems over time become less efficient and lose energy. A large coal-fired electric power plant, for example, inevitably wastes about 67% of the energy content of the coal. Automobile engines in the human body are even less efficient, wasting about 80% of available energy. An imaginary perpetual motion machine would have to defy the second law of thermodynamics in order to function. And this principle applies not only to heat energy. For example, natural processes move toward equilibrium and homogeneity rather than towards ordered states. For example, they quote, a cube of sugar dissolved in coffee does not naturally reassemble as a cube. Perfume molecules in air do not naturally gather again in a perfume bottle. The entropy principle also plays an important part of information theory, which it denotes the tendency of communications to become confused by noise or static. An example of this is the practice of photocopying materials. As such materials are repeatedly copied and recopied, their information is continually degraded until they become unintelligible. Based on this principle, then, how is it over time, we're speaking in an evolutionary term of millions, not billions of years, the life appeared and became progressively more complex and efficient. If one is an atheist and has no other explanation of the presence of life on Earth except for evolution, then he's forced to say that somehow a miracle occurred, and the governing principle of entropy was shunted aside to create this world. Yeah, and you think only religious people believe in miracles. This principle of entropy and devolution manifests itself in Torah literature in various aspects of life. And first, regarding spirituality, here on page 3, there's a Gemara in Shabbos in Kuf Yud Beis Omid Beis, 112b. Reb Zera said, this is in the name of Rav Bar Zimuna, if the tzaddikim of the earlier generation were sons of angels, then we're the sons of men. The tzaddikim, in the sense of the earlier generations, were sons of men, then we're like donkeys. Not even like the donkey of Chanina ben Doisa, Pinchas ben Yor, who were spiritually sensitive, but like common donkeys. In other words, man has, instead of evolved, we've devolved. In terms of our understanding, there's a Gemara in Erevin in the Gimel Amud Aleph. Rabbi Yochanan stated, the hearts, means the intellectual capacity of the ancients, were like the door of the Ulam. room was a very large door. It was 40 cubits tall and 20 cubits wide. But that of the last generation was like the door of the Heichel, of the sanctuary, which is smaller, 20 cubits, like a quarter, 20 cubits tall and 10 cubits wide. But ours is like the eye of a fine needle. And goes on to give examples. In terms of beauty, there's a Gemara in Bava Basra in paragraph C, in Chesomad Aleph, 58a. Rabbi Noah said, I discerned his Adam's two heels like two orbs of the sun. Compared with Sora, all other people like a monkey to a human being. And compared with Eve, Sora is like a monkey to a human being. And compared with Adam, Eve was like a monkey to a human being. And compared with the Shekhinah, Adam was like a monkey to a human being. Rav Kahana's beauty is a reflection of Rabbi Abohu's. Rabbi Abohu's a reflection of our patriarch Yaakov. Our patriarch is a reflection of Adam's, but all in a diminished state. And here there's a medrash on paragraph E. You can take a look at it. That deals with the fact that originally man had a tail. It was subsequently removed to preserve man's dignity. But it may be the source of the possibility, at least, in of having some vestigial tail. But it's interesting about, I thought this is an interesting idea. But the idea of devolution in terms from man to monkey has a precedent as well, which we're going to speak of in a future lecture. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Kuftes, or Medallah from 109a. Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar said those who were involved in building the Tower of Babel split into three parties. One said, let us ascend and dwell there. Says, dwell in heaven. We'll discuss what this means in that lecture devoted to this. The second, let us ascend and serve idols. And the third said, let us ascend and wage war with God. The party which proposed, let us ascend and dwell there, the Lord scattered them. And the one that said, let us ascend and wage war, were turned into apes, spirits, devils, and night demons. Will says, for the party which said, let us ascend and serve idols, for there the Lord did confound the language of all of the earth. But there is a notion of men turning into apes. And therefore the idea is of apes descending from man, at least in some form, is really not without precedent. But just again, in conclusion, the text of the Torah seems clearly to describe the creation of man as being unique and not part of some evolutionary process. According to evolutionary thought, man is a product of evolution, is descended from lower forms, most recently ape-like creatures. The problem is there is still no clear-cut, uncontested evidence for such an evolution, or that the fossils that were found were actually ancestral to man. The lack of evidence is not necessarily proof against evolution, but it does serve as a challenge. Regarding the little fossil evidence that has been found, Lyle Watson wrote in the May 1982 issue of Science Digest, quote, the fossils that decorate our family tree are so scarce that there are still more scientists than specimens. The remarkable fact is that all the physical evidence we have from human evolution can still be placed with room to spare inside a single coffin. It's also important to note that there does exist a great gulf between the apes and man, and not only in spirituality, intelligence, and speech. As biology professor John W. Klotz noted in his article, The Case for Evolution, in Darwin, Evolution and Creation, published in 1959, quote, the human nose has a prominent bridge and an elongated tip, which is lacking in the apes. Continued on, man has red lips formed by an outrolling of the mucous membrane which lines the inside of his mouth. Apes do not have this. Apes have thumbs on their feet as well as their hands. Man has the greatest weight at birth in relation to his weight as an adult, yet at birth he shows the least degree of maturation, is by far the most helpless of creatures. Man's head is balanced on top of a spinal column. The head of the ape is hinged at the front instead at the top, end quote. So we are very different. Despite the concerted effort by the secular establishment to the contrary, all evidence points to the fact that we are unique and have always been so. Okay, a good tavach. Mirz Hashem, I'll see you in 2 weeks.